Traditional revenue sources for public media and media at large are declining this year, and we at Marketplace are not immune to those trends. We're currently tracking behind target for this budget year. We're tightening up our expenses, yes, but the need for trusted, grounded, fact-based reporting is as pressing as ever, and we simply cannot cut back on our mission. So we're turning to the listeners like you. Please step up now and invest in Marketplace. If you haven't given yet, now's the time. Go to marketplace.org/donate. The economic buzzword of this week, jobs, from American Public Media. This is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdal. Monday, today, 28 August. Good as always to have you along, everybody. We will be getting data on jobs this week. Lots and lots of data on jobs. Tomorrow, it'll be JOLTS, the Job Openings and Labor Turnover Survey, along with the quits rate. That's people leaving their jobs voluntarily for new and, one assumes, better paying jobs. Then on Wednesday, it's private payrolls from ADP. First time claims for unemployment on Thursday. And then Friday, the biggie, the August jobs report. And with jobs, of course, come paychecks. And one of the key things that people are going to be watching in that Friday jobs report is wage growth. It has been blamed by some and discounted by others as a key driver of inflation. Average hourly earnings, which is the official nomenclature, were growing at nearly 6% annually in the spring of last year, then fell back a bit when the Fed started raising interest rates. And as Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman reports to get us going today, there are some signs that wage growth may be slowing further.
The wages that employers post to hire new employees can tell us a lot about how much demand there is for workers and how desperate employers are to pay whatever it takes to get them. So Nick Bunker at online job site Indeed, which is a Marketplace underwriter, closely follows the trend in posted wages.
It potentially is a leading indicator because when employers are trying to add someone to staff right now, that's more indicative of the current tightness of the labor market than what has happened to wages of workers already in a job.
Bunker says posted wage growth has slowed from 5.8% a year back in April to 4.7% in July. If the trend continues, it'll be back to pre-pandemic levels by December. That's not great for workers, but it'll be welcome news for the Fed, which wants to see the labor market cool down. Julia Pollack at ZipRecruiter says that's what her firm's data is showing.
When employers are posting jobs, they are clearly trying to reset expectations. We have seen more categories, industries, and more job titles show declines in average posted wages than increases.
The slowdown is evident among small businesses, says Luke Pardue at HR and payroll firm Gusto.
As economic uncertainty has risen, as we are seeing the highest interest rates in over 20 years, small businesses aren't adding jobs at the pace that they were last year. We've seen this cool down in the job market translate to slower wage growth.
It's down to 2% from 5% a year ago among the businesses that Gusto tracks. Companies are also paying less to new hires.
And what that's telling me is that workers are losing a little bit of leverage in this labor market. And so businesses are having an easier time expanding when they want to. And workers aren't necessarily seeing that pay bump when they want to change jobs.
Businesses are still trying hard to retain the workers they've already hired, though, offering richer benefits even as they give skimpier raises. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
Wall Street on this Monday, the last week of August, is starting out strong. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Troubled power grid in the state of Texas. Think back to that ice storm a couple of years ago. It is in a jam again as record temperatures persist, high temperatures this time. The operator of the independent Texas grid has asked customers four times last week to use less power so it could keep the grid online. And among the challenges down there is that the number of electricity users in Texas is growing all the time. It's home to many of the fastest growing cities in the country, Texas is, as people look for new jobs and more affordable housing across the Sun Belt. So from Houston, Marketplace's Elizabeth Trovall explains how all that Texas growth is also straining the Texas grid.
More people have moved to Texas in the past 20 years than to any other state, some 9 million people, according to census data.
The joke is, you know, California is moving to Texas. Well, we have seen a lot of that, and everybody here wants an air conditioner, and I don't blame them.
Austinite Joshua Rhodes is an energy researcher with the University of Texas and dealing with an energy crisis of his own today.
My AC is out, so I'm having a good time down here.
As for those with functioning ACs, Rhodes says they're a big contributor to peak demand numbers on sweltering Texas afternoons.
Over half of that demand is coming from the residential sector, and the majority of that is coming from air conditioning.
This summer, peak demand for the Texas grid is 11,000 megawatts more than it was 2 years ago. Grid operator data shows that growth like that took 10 years last time it happened. Consultant Doug Lewin is with Stoic Energy.
I struggle to find adjectives to express how just wild these levels of demand are, particularly not just to see it once, but day after day after day.
Ann Lewin says the demand for electricity is also increasing in other new ways.
We're at 220,000 electric vehicles in Texas. That number is going to shoot up in coming years.
He proposes that newcomers become part of the solution.
We could have a robust system to like help people get solar panels and storage and live in energy efficient homes. That's entirely possible with the right policy.
And Texas, a leader in energy production, is up for the challenge, says Glenn Hammer with the Texas Association of Business.
It's almost like a home team advantage that we have here because of the culture and energy in Texas.
Andy says the growth that is adding to the grid's load, that's not a bad problem to have. I'm Elizabeth Trovall for Marketplace.
Here's today's logistics insight into this economy. Trucks move about 73% of all domestic freight. And in 2021, truckers traveled about 300 billion miles to do it. The data comes from American Trucking Associations. Yes, plural, it's a consortium of state trucking groups. And anyway, all that stuff, moving all those miles on diesel big rigs, you know what the next sentence is, right? Trucking has a big climate footprint, very big. And eventually, it's going to have to go electric. But as Will Walkie reports from the Mountain West News Bureau, the road to electric trucks is a long one.
The Petro Travel Center off of Interstate 80 in Laramie, Wyoming, is like a gas station on steroids. Truck drivers stop here to grab a meal, fix a tie down, or refuel, including long hauler Richard Summers. Like a lot of drivers here, he's just passing through.
I came out of Portland, Oregon. I'm headed to Chesapeake, Virginia, and then home to South Carolina.
He's been driving trucks for 30 years.
I just enjoy traveling and getting paid to see everything nobody else gets to. You know, my dad was a trucker, my grandpa was a trucker, my cousins are truckers.
Drivers like him are vital for getting consumer goods from warehouses and ports to retail stores. But although medium and heavy-duty trucks make up just 5% of vehicles on the road, they're responsible for about a quarter of transportation emissions. It's no secret that this sector needs to go green, and some companies are ready to capitalize on that. Tesla CEO Elon Musk unveiled a sleek electric semi last year. The semi can go up to 500 miles per charge. A few companies have already bought some, including Pepsi. Other manufacturers like Peterbilt and Volvo also sell electric rigs. Bernd Hyde is with the research firm McKinsey. He says electric trucks will likely get cheaper over time. Plus, maintenance and fuel costs are typically lower. And because these trucks drive so many miles, that makes a difference.
This coast-to-coast trucking, if you do the math with a fuel cell electric truck versus a diesel truck, at a certain point, that will break even.
But some truckers are not convinced that electric is the way to go, including Richard Summers.
It's just not feasible right now. We don't have the technology. We're getting there, just not ready yet.
For one, electric big rigs can cost hundreds of thousands of dollars, usually two or three times more than diesel trucks. The batteries are also heavy, which means drivers can't carry as much cargo. And although the federal government is spending billions to build chargers, there aren't enough yet. And that's what worries Louis Pugh. He's with an independent drivers association. Most diesel trucks can get enough fuel for a day or two of traveling in less than 15 minutes at the pump.
Whereas with these trucks, the way I understand, you charge them, you got a 300, maybe 500, maybe 600 mile range, and then they have to charge.
And that can take anywhere from 30 minutes to 8 hours, depending on which chargers are available. The Biden administration and some states want to phase out emissions from heavy-duty vehicles in the next couple of decades. They're trying to incentivize truckers to switch, sometimes with clean air mandates, sometimes with tax incentives. Pugh understands that the switch to electric is happening, but doesn't want the government to force it before it's practical.
When you're talking our national supply chain, you can't just say, oh, we'll figure it out.
Pugh wants to be sure that these new trucks and the charging systems work to get his drivers and the goods they transport where they need to go. In Laramie, Wyoming, I'm Will Waukee for Marketplace.
We're going to stick with transportation here for a minute, but we're going to take a turn to rail. A new passenger rail service was supposed to open in Florida this coming weekend from Miami up to Orlando. That has been delayed. No new opening date set so far, but the plan is that this would be an extension of a rail line operated by a private company called Brightline. Brightline, not Amtrak, which does run pretty much every other passenger train in this country. The company also plans to build a passenger train from Los Angeles to Las Vegas, which it hopes to open in time for the 2028 Olympics, which are going to be here in L.A. Thing is, projects like those can cost billions of dollars, and passenger rail is not really known for its big profits. So Marketplace's Henry Epp looked into why private companies are getting into the rail game.
Back in the day, private companies took passengers on trains all over the U.S. all the time, says Robert Puentes, the head of the Eno Center for Transportation.
Within cities, between cities, all across the country. And then in the 1970s, it all started to change.
Rail companies were losing money on passenger trains, so Congress created Amtrak to run the routes instead. But outside the Northeast, passenger rail has kind of limped along ever since. One reason, Amtrak mostly relies on freight rail tracks, and those cargo trains often get to go first. That leads to delays for Amtrak. In Florida, it's different. The company developing the new route also owns the tracks and a bunch of nearby real estate, says John Robert Smith, chair of the group Transportation for America.
This was a real estate development project for them. And as they built out the rail, they built out apartments and condominiums.
That gave the company built-in ridership. Brightline got millions of dollars from the government for the Florida project, but out west, they're asking for nearly $4 billion from the feds. And that's typical.
Passenger rail needs a public subsidy to work.
Adi Tomer is a senior fellow at Brookings.
That's the case for driving in terms of highways or air travel in terms of the airports and air traffic control systems.
And right now, there's federal money up for grabs from the infrastructure law passed a few years ago, Tomer says, and that presents an opportunity for new rail.
For private market entrants to look for areas where they can turn a profit both for their shareholders while still offering a competitive service to their passengers.
Still, there's a wild card, climate change. Railroad tracks across the South have warped this summer under extreme heat, and coastal erosion is threatening lines in California. Again, Robert Puentes at the Eno Center.
We've got to make sure that the infrastructure that is being built now is going to be resilient.
Not just for today, but for a warmer climate going forward. I'm Henry Epp for Marketplace.
Coming up.
Maybe the outside world hasn't caught on yet, but all of us on the inside know that.
If you don't know, now you know. First, though, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrial is up 213 points on this Monday, 0.6%, closed at 34,559. The NASDAQ gained 114 points, about 0.8%, finished at 13,705. The S&P 500 up 27 points, about 0.6%, 4,433 there. Industrial giant 3M grew 5.2%. Bloomberg reported the firm had struck a tentative deal to settle lawsuits from combat veterans over faulty earplugs. Bloomberg reports that deal would cost 3M more than $5.5 billion with a B dollars. Boston Scientific added almost 6%. Today over the weekend, the medical device maker announced positive results for its treatment for patients with abnormal heartbeats. Akero Therapeutics was up 4.2% today after UBS initiated coverage of the biotech term with a buy rating. Biotech firm, rather. A recent study in the JAMA Health Forum showed that the number of mental health care visits increased substantially during the COVID-19 pandemic. The study involved some 7 million American adults who have health insurance through their employer. It found that from March 2020 to August 2022, mental health visits went up by 39%. Bond prices went up as well. Yield on the 10-year T-note, 4.20%. You're listening to Marketplace. Traditional revenue sources for public media and media at large are declining this year, and we at Marketplace are not immune to those trends. We're currently tracking behind target for this budget year. We're tightening up our expenses, yes, but the need for trusted, grounded, fact-based reporting is as pressing as ever, and we simply cannot cut back on our mission. So we're turning to the listeners like you. Please step up now and invest in Marketplace. If you haven't given yet, now's the time. Go to marketplace.org/donate.
My name is Lee Hawkins. I've been a journalist for over 25 years. On my new podcast, What Happened in Alabama, I get answers to some of the hardest questions about how things came to be for many Black Americans and the truth that must come before any reconciliation can happen. I investigate my family history, my upbringing in Minnesota, and my father's painful nightmares about growing up in Alabama. What Happened in Alabama is a new series confronting the cycles of trauma for myself, my family, and for many Black Americans. Listen now.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. As we approach the waning days of summer, persistent heat waves notwithstanding, a moment now for that perfect summer peach. The flavor, the juiciness, the cost. Sorry to spoil the moment, but over the past couple of months, retail peach prices have been up as much as 25%, or depending on where you are, 50%. Some unpeachy weather this season has led to shortages in places like Georgia and Illinois, as Will Bauer reports now from Harvest Public Media.
In deep southern Illinois, Flam Orchards is known for its peaches. Farm manager Austin Flam is walking me into his orchard's processing facility.
This is such an untypical year.
He points to a conveyor belt where he processes the fruit. It's off. Usually thousands of peaches would be running down it to be cleaned, sorted, and stored.
You got to use a little bit of imagination this year. While the line's not running, it doesn't give an accurate representation.
And the reason it's not running? A Midwest cold spell in late December knocked out 90 to 95% of his crop this year. In the big refrigerator-like warehouse where Flam stores his peaches, the crop loss is just as obvious. It would normally be full of huge bins packed with peaches, but it's nearly empty.
To have a loss as bad as we've had this year, it's very rare. This is the worst loss we've had in about 16 seasons, since 2007.
Across the U.S., other peach orchards struggled too, and because of weather, but not the same kind of weather. While the cold got to the Midwest fruit, it was hot spring weather that hurt the peach crop in the southeast. In Georgia, which is of course the peach state, farmers lost 90% of their crop this year. Duke Lane III is the president of the state's Peach Council and a farmer himself. He says it was the worst year since 1955.
And so it's hard to say we're due, like that doesn't feel good, but it's not the first time it's happened, and it won't be the last.
There is a bit of good news for peach fans. California season was healthy and robust. And while the Southeast, in Georgia especially, are known for peaches, California is actually the top producer,
by quite a bit. Kay Rentzel, the executive director of the National Peach Council, says California had good weather for growing peaches.
California has had a fabulous year. They had a lot of rain early on, which was atypical of their climates, but certainly they've had a good year.
Regardless, peach buyers may still notice a lack of local fruit in parts of the country hit with that crummy weather. Rentzel says if you're lucky enough to find peaches, you can still expect great quality.
They might be priced higher this year. The quality, the flavor will be exquisite.
For farmers in hard-hit areas, the financial hits can be big. Near St. Louis, seventh-generation peach farmer Chris Eckert says it's tough to guesstimate just how much he lost until he does all the math.
Our overall is probably more like half a crop. We're going to be pretty excited about a half a crop if we can get that.
And mysteriously, the weather hit different peach varieties in different ways. The Gala took the Midwest cold poorly, while the Red Haven did pretty well. Eckert's best explanation?
That's kind of the world we live in, is the weather is different always. These types of one-off situations are not that unusual in our world.
He can't say for certain this is because of climate change, but he does say,
it's like, well, that's never happened before. This disease never was here before. That insect was never here before.
The U.S. Department of Agriculture does offer crop insurance for peaches, so farmers will be able to recoup some of this loss. In the meantime, farmers like Eckert are hoping that next year will be better. In Belleville, Illinois, I'm Will Bauer for Marketplace.
You know who's a peach? David Brancaccio and the gang on the Marketplace Morning Report. Really, David's just a good guy. They get out of bed every single day real early to set you up with your business and economic news. Check it out. Inflation has been a challenge for everybody the past couple of years. Consumers, of course. Businesses, too, though, big and small. Specifically, on the income statement line that reads cost of goods sold. In plainer terms, how long can those small businesses keep passing along rising costs before they really start to alienate their customers? And it's a challenge in particular in specialty retail. Marketplace's Savannah Marr went to the biggest Native American art show in North America.
Every August, Santa Fe Indian Market draws some of the very best Native artists and craftspeople from all over the continent, like John Murray, who's known for his beaded moccasins.
I'm from Rocky Boy, Montana, Chippewa Cree tribe.
Murray lucked out this year with a booth right on Santa Fe's historic plaza where there's plenty of foot traffic. After a day and a half, he's made a couple of big sales.
I did pretty good. I've sold about half my inventory. I have a little bit left for today. Hopefully I'll sell a little bit more.
Like a small green vest waiting for some very stylish kid to take it home.
The vest took quite a while to do. It's fully beaded on the front and the back, so that's $3,200 with the tie.
And how do you figure out how to price your items, especially once you start having to factor in inflation?
Yeah, see, it's getting harder and harder to factor in that inflation.
Murray says he's paying a lot more for beads and smoked animal hides than he was 2 years ago. Maybe as much as 30% more. But he can only raise prices so many times before his sales start to slow down. A few rows over, another artist, Christy Ruby, is also dealing with higher costs.
Well, when I heard the ammo was going up, you know, I actually bought everything I could probably use for the next 10 years.
Yep, she said ammo. Ruby is Tlingit from Ketchikan, Alaska. She hunts seals and sea otters herself, then tans the furs and sews them into winter wear. Her mittens and scarves seem pretty luxurious to me.
But you can also go shovel your driveway and use it to muck out horse stalls if you want.
She uses a pricing formula that accounts for the rising cost of ammunition and travel and boat fuel.
Cost of goods, cost of materials, cost of time, multiply that times 3.
Which, lately, comes out to around $600 for a sealskin bomber hat. But that equation doesn't take into account the generations of innovation and traditional knowledge that go into just about everything for sale at Indian Market. It's a collection here of all priceless pieces, says Elizabeth James Perry, who's a Quinnawampanoag from Martha's Vineyard and makes wampum jewelry.
Maybe the outside world hasn't caught on yet, but all of us on the inside know that.
Perry says many of the artists here can't charge what these works of art are truly worth, because their work is marginalized in the world of fine art. She says collectors expect even very high-end Native art to be affordable, and that means Native artists' labor gets undervalued.
If we got paid per hour, it would be like a nickel an hour.
Karen Lynn Hill is Onondaga from New York, and she's showing me a red velvet hat she created.
And what did you land on for that hat?
400.
Just 400.
The hat is stunning, with intricate yellow raised beadwork in the Haudenosaunee tradition. She worked on it for about 6 weeks.
And to tell you the truth, I'd put it at 800 if I thought I could sell it.
Hill has been coming to Indian Market for a decade now. And for her, it's not all about moving inventory. She says it's a chance to rub shoulders with some of the most talented artists in the world, and for her work to be in conversation with theirs.
To me, this is the best of the best. And I'm sitting here.
Hill says if she goes home to New York with a lighter suitcase and her travel costs covered, the trip will have been worth it. In Santa Fe, I'm Savannah Marr for Marketplace.
This final note on the way out today, an update from Gallup about worker engagement with their jobs in this economy of ours. It is up, but first of all, engagement overall is up after a dip during and just after the pandemic. 34% of employees say they are engaged with their work. That is up 2 percentage points from a year ago. But as I said, but employees who are fully remote have what Gallup characterizes as an eroding connection to the mission and purpose of their organization. 28% strongly agreed that they feel connected. I should say just, because that ties the record low for that metric set in 2011. All right, we're going here, though, is your moment of economic context. Next time you can't find something that you want to stream, think about this. Saw it on Bloomberg. It is data from Nielsen. Over the past 2 years, the number of shows on streaming services is up 39% to 2.35 million titles. You add in over-the-air broadcast and cable, and your options grow to 2.7 million. So there's got to be something good on, right? Our daily production team, which gets this show on, is Levy Burdett, Andy Corbin, Richard Cunningham, Maria Hollenhorst, Sarah Leeson, Sean McHenry, and Sophia Terenzio. I'm Kai Rizdal. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
Hey, everyone. It's Rima Khreis, host of This Is Uncomfortable. If you're looking for some good recommendations on books to read, well, you should join This Is Uncomfortable's Summer Book Club. Every other week in our newsletter, we'll share a new book that'll make you rethink your relationship to money, class, and work, while also featuring an interview with the author or an expert on the topic. Plus, when you join, you'll be entered in a giveaway where you could win some This Is Uncomfortable merch. Be sure to check it out. Sign up today at marketplace.org/bookclub.